Judiciary order today is February 18th, 2011. The fire marshal has a occupancy rules in here. We have an overflow. A TV camera is right down below us downstairs in the Senate lounge. Those seated, you know, please stay. If you're going to testify and have signed up and you're not seated, if you go down, we will call your name. You can come up. It's close by, but we do need to not have everybody standing so that the fire marshal doesn't come and throw my good lawyer, Bill Taylor, in jail. The first item on the today is House Bill 2707.
We're going to go to this one here, 2714.
2714. We'll be out of order. And another announcement, House Bill 2999. We are not going to hear today. We have discovered we need some more work on that, so we're not going to have that hearing. So 2999 is off. Representative Tomei, please proceed. Oh, I'm sorry. Allow. Mr. Taylor, could you give us a brief description?
Members of the committee, this bill comes to you from Representative Tomei. What the bill does creates a crime of patronizing a prostitute or the person that pays or offers to pay a fee to another in order to engage in a sex act, classifies a crime as a Class A misdemeanor, sets a fine to $20,000 if the person to whom the fee was offered was under 18, does not require the state to prove the person knew the person's age. If the court determines the defendant is unable to pay $20,000, the court may impose a lesser fine, but whatever it pays, it cannot waive the fine. It amends the prostitution statute to remove the provision as it relates. It creates two separate provisions, Mr. Chairman of the Committee.
Okay, please proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, and members of the committee. I'm State Representative Carolyn Tomei, and I thank you for scheduling House Bill 2714 today, dealing with the sex trafficking of children. I know we have a busy schedule, so I'm going to keep my comments brief. This is a very important issue to me, to my constituents, and to the residents of this state. Oregon has gained the unfortunate reputation as a hub for sex trafficking of children. Young girls and boys are routinely being sold on the streets of Portland. These children have been frequently victimized and they need treatment and services. These are not foreign nationals. They have not been imported to this state. They come from our cities, our suburbs, and our rural towns. These children pose very difficult problems. Appropriate shelter and treatment is hard to find. They often don't see themselves as victims, so they tend, when they are placed into a group home, they tend to run away. Law enforcement has a hard time getting them to testify against their pimps. It is a very, very difficult situation. Many advocates have stepped forward to address this problem. Law enforcement, child welfare workers, treatment providers, religious groups. I want to especially thank the City of Portland and Multnomah County officials for their work for these young victims. Senator Ron Wyden has been a strong voice in advocating for federal funds for shelters. And here in Salem, a group of stakeholders has developed a package of legislation to give these children the tools and these folks who are advocating for them, the tools they need to help these children. House Bill 2714 is just one piece of that package. It deals with the crime of prostitution. Currently, both the buyer and the seller of sex are charged with the crime of prostitution. This has led to some question in sentencing. We want to punish the pimps and the buyers, but we want to be able to send the children to treatment. Specifically, House Bill 2714 separates the crime in two. One is patronizing a prostitute, and the other is prostitution itself. It imposes a whopping $20,000 fine on those who buy sex from minors. It also establishes strict liability. Ignorance of age is no defense. If you are buying sex from a child, regardless of whether you thought she or he was over 18, you are still subject to a $20,000 fine. We also have amendments drafted to post the buyer's picture on the internet. Buying sex from a child is a very serious crime, and we want penalties to reflect that. At this point, we're still collecting data about the effectiveness of internet internet posting, but I want this message to be very clear. Children are off limits. And just a word about some of the other pieces of legislation addressing sex trafficking. They had their first hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee last week, and they have several goals. We want to give law enforcement better tools to prosecute the traffickers. We want to send a strong message to those who patronize young prostitutes that children are now off limits. We want to educate law enforcement officers to recognize that these young prostitutes are victims, not criminals. And we want to develop the resources needed to help these young victims with safety, shelter, and treatment.
My hope that the entire package will be coming
to the House floor soon. College sex trafficking of children is a serious problem here and now in Oregon. It has long-lasting effects on its victims. Washington State has taken steps to combat it. California's laws are stricter than ours. House Bill 2714 is one step we need to better protect our children. I know we have several people who are ready to testify, so you might want to hold their questions for them unless you have a quick question that I might be able to answer. We have a couple of young women here who are here to testify. I'd appreciate it if you'd let them testify now.
Thank you. Please go ahead. And identify yourself. You need to say your name for the record. Thank you.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and members of the committee. I am Brianna West, and this is Jillian Pope. We are eighth graders at Leslie Middle School doing a project called Change the World.
Change the World is a project where eighth graders choose a problem in the world, research it, and try to make a difference. We chose sex trafficking because we know it's happening here in Oregon.
When I first heard that Portland, Oregon is considered the center of sex trafficking empire in America, I was devastated. For me, the thought that women and girls my age were falling victim to this appalling predicament was truly frightening. My first exposure to the idea that sex trafficking could affect anyone was when I watched the movie Taken. When my mom realized this was something I wanted to know more about, she started emailing me news stories about the issue. When the Change the World project came up, not surprisingly, this was the first thing that came to my mind. At the start of this project, our philosophy was simple. I've got the connections and she's got the coffee. However, as we started to research this more and more and find out all the different statistics, we jumped from, this is a cool project, to, I really want to make a difference. Statistics that really jumped out were things like the fact that currently there are thousands of people who are victims to sex trafficking in America alone, and that this industry generates $19 billion a year all over the globe.
Our original approach was to accumulate signatures from students and staff at our school and mail them, along with a supporting letter, to our senators and representatives. But when Brianna's mother arranged for us to speak here today, our plan changed slightly. These are the sheets of signatures we collected. There are 517 in all. That many students signed a petition to end sex trafficking, and that's only one school in Oregon.
Today, you're hearing testimony about House Bill 2714. This session, you may also have the opportunity to hear Senate Bills 425, 426, 427, and 429. We are here with our signatures to ask the committee to support this legislation as one step in preventing sex trafficking. When we leave here today, we will be leaving copies of this testimony with other legislatures throughout the Capitol in the hope that they, too, will take a stand in this important issue. Thank you. We can answer any questions.
Thank you very much. That's some of the best testimony I've heard in the 8 years I've been here. You guys did an excellent job.
You did.
Is there any questions for the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Testimony, I think we should just vote.
Ready? Yeah, we're not in work session. Randy Ellison, Greg Mowad, and Sybil Hebb, please. Go ahead, or just please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Greg Mowat, and I'm here on behalf of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and the Oregon District Attorney's Association, and I want to thank Chair Barker and Chair Krieger and the rest of the members of this committee for giving us an opportunity to be here. For the last number of years, I've had the opportunity to work in a unit that specializes in human trafficking. Had been fortunate enough to work with Representative Tomei in drafting of some of this legislation. What struck me is the carnage that this crime of prostitution and trafficking creates in the young in the women that are victimized by this. We are working in the Senate to enhance legislation to address the traffickers. This is the one bill that will address the demand side of the problem, which is the Johns. We have discussed some of the concerns about the number of the fine. We can have an argument whether $20,000 is appropriate, $8,000 is appropriate, but we needed something to bring attention to the issue, but would still give the judge the opportunity in those cases in which the fine is not appropriate due to cruel and unusual concerns, the judge could modify it. In my opinion, this bill is a strong John demand side bill that needs to be passed.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, also here today to thank the committee and the sponsors for their consideration and support of this proposal, and to offer the Law Center's support. And from our perspective, and we see people in civil proceedings, and we don't handle the criminal side of this aspect, but so many of our clients come into our offices seeking assistance because of the trauma and the chaos that suffering from domestic or sexual violence has wrought on their lives. And the dynamic of being caught in the cycle or the control web of trafficking for young victims is creates similar chaos and similar damage to those victims. And so from that perspective, we're really supportive of two of the basic principles of this bill. And one is separating the crimes. When a young person is forced into prostitution, the act of selling that is very, very different from the act of buying the right to someone's body. And it's appropriate from a policy-based perspective to separate those two forms of behavior. And it's additionally appropriate to create an additional sanction for the people who are purchasing for the Johns. And the financial sanction, we hope, will not impose a fiscal impact on the courts, but will have a significant impact on the person's ability to move forward with his life. It will make a significant difference in that person's life and hopefully be a deterrent. We also very much appreciate the way that this bill is drafted such that it allows the judge the discretion to make the award, the damages request appropriate for the circumstances, so that if someone is in a situation in which they're supporting a family or unable to make a payment, the judge can take that into consideration. The only other point I would make is that victims of child trafficking, national statistics show, suffer many, many other forms of abuse at the hands of their pimps. Often they are sexually abused, they're physically abused. They also suffer an increased incidence of mental health issues throughout their lives, more suicide attempts, and dissociative disorders. And so this is something that we need to stop at the beginning of the process as quickly and as effectively as we can. So thank you.
My name is Randy Ellison, Chairman Barker, Chairman Krieger. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today. I'm president of OASIS, the Oregon Abuse Advocates and Survivors in Service. I am speaking in support of House Bill 2714, and I want to thank you for considering it today. I'm involved in the issues of child sex abuse because I was a victim as a teenager. My life was filled with many forms of dysfunction, including alcohol and drug addictions that lasted 40 years. I was a lucky one. I was able to survive through that and live through it, and with help have come out the other side. The children we're talking about here, mostly girls aged 12 to 17, may not be so lucky. Studies indicate that 90% of teenage prostitutes were sexually abused earlier in life as children. They end up dropping out of school, leaving home, becoming part of an invisible culture. They are lost to their families and lost to society. The pain and suffering that these children live with every minute, every day and night only increases over time. I can attest to that. Many attempt suicide, many succeed. You may have read in the Oregonian in the last few weeks a case of a child sex abuse by a man that once walked these very halls. A child with a bright future who ended up, after severe problems and addictions, physically wasting away and dying at age 42. This is not a rare story. a life destroyed by an adult man assuming it was okay to have sex with a child. Census records indicate there are 48,000 babies born in Oregon every year. Statistics tell us 10,000 of these children will become victims of child sex abuse before they turn 18. How many of these victims will become victims of sex trafficking? I don't have the statistics. 1%, 2%, 5%. But are we willing to risk 100 to 500 of our children born every year to this kind of a life?
How many are too many? This bill gives law enforcement a powerful tool to prosecute people who are seeking out sex with our children and paying big money for it.
In the news this week, there was a story of a 52-year-old founder of two grocery store chains arrested for using the internet to arrange sex with a teenage girl. This is exactly what this bill is about and what it addresses. This week, the Jackson County United Way Community Building Committee took a stand and voted to recommend to their board of directors that they support these bills along with the other six that are currently in the Senate. This is a statewide problem. Melissa Farley, the executive director of Prostitution Research and Education, put it this way: people are willing to ignore the sexual exploitation of women in our culture. Unfortunately, we're not talking about women here. We're talking about girls, underage children, ones we're charged to protect. I beg you to take a stand to stop this shameful for-profit business going on in our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions at this panel? Representative Krieger, please.
Maybe not necessarily a question. We see the $20,000 fine. And I know, I've got 17 grandkids. I know members of this committee have daughters. And this is, we kind of know what's going on, but it's kind of off to the side. So I really appreciate Representative Tomei bringing it forward. Now, I've been accused of being a little bit crude, but I'll tell you something. I can think of a deterrent that would just take care of this problem. And, years ago that used to happen. And I spoke, Mr. Bradbury over there is chuckling. But, I wouldn't hesitate a second. And I think there's a lot of men wouldn't hesitate a second to take care of it. And we wouldn't have any repeat offenders.
Amen, brother.
Representative Krieger. I would also just say that for many people I've talked to people over the years, and I've dealt with prostitutes. I'm a retired police officer, but so many people seem to think prostitution is Pretty Woman, the movie. They think it's all like this big happy ending coming up, good ending. They don't realize that so many times it's the 15-year-old girl with dirt on the back of her life and just coming off the farm, and their lives are ruined and down the future. And people have talked about $20,000 is too high. There was a study done in Canada that showed most of the men involved with underage prostitution were professional men. So is $20 a big enough fine? $20,000 should get some people's attention. And we do need to put a stop to this. It's just seems to be getting worse and worse. And I really thank you, the panel, for taking time to come testify today. Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just wanted to acknowledge the good work of Commissioner Diane McKeel, who has worked tirelessly on this issue for the last 2 years. She's a good friend and neighbor of ours out in East County, and I thank you, the Multnomah County DA's office, for working together with her. I'm definitely on board. Thank you.
Thank you.
Emily Trussell, Ms. Tara Sweet,
and Andrew Olson, please.
Go ahead. My name is Andrew Olson. I'm a policy analyst for Multnomah County Commissioner Diane McKeel. She asked me to come on her behalf today because she is actually in Los Angeles this weekend or the coming weekend to speak to this at a conference down there. So she asked me to read this short statement on her behalf. I want to thank the committee for taking up this bill and the difficult issue it attempts to address. This bill is one of the first steps towards treating the victims of sex trafficking as the victims they are, not criminals, and imposing real punishment upon those who victimize them. This and some of the other bills that you will be facing this session will not solve the problem of sex trafficking in our state, but they are an important part of a statewide effort that must take place. Only through cooperation and collaboration among the federal government, the state, cities, counties, and the citizens of our state will this issue ever be fully resolved. In Multnomah County, we are administering a federal grant from the Department of Justice designed to coordinate and organize all the government, nonprofit, and stakeholder groups that are working to end commercial sexual exploitation in our region. We're moving forward very quickly to ensure that our efforts are coordinated and efficiently managed, our resources well spent, and our goals achieved. We've also created a diversion program for those arrested for attempting to buy sex. The Sex Buyer Accountability and Diversion Program educates Johns on the dangers of buying sex, the harm that it causes to those they buy it from, and puts to rest any ideas that they may have had that prostitution is a victimless crime. The mandatory $1,000 fee paid by each John that takes part in the class will provide funding for law enforcement, treatment, and prosecution. And in conjunction with the City of Portland and Janus Youth Programs, we have worked to establish the first few shelter beds in Oregon for the victims of this exploitation. Without question, the biggest gap in services that currently exists for victims of human trafficking is a lack of any shelter to safely house and treat its victims. Janus Youth Programs has joined us to administer these beds with the understanding that these victims need stability and understanding more than anything else. A safe place to live, these victims will be able to get the much-needed mental and physical wraparound treatment they deserve, while also helping law enforcement get the testimony they need to convict those who continue to abuse. Only through work by all forms of government will we ever see this terrible crime come to an end. If we continue to work together to strengthen laws, punish exploiters, and aid victims, we will show the predators and abusers in our state that their business is no longer welcome here. Passing House Bill 2714 is a great step forward towards that goal. Thanks to leaders at the federal, state, and local levels, we are making real progress, but there is much left to do. I thank you for giving this bill a hearing, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, and please thank the Commissioner for all the work she's doing on this. We recognize that. Well, let's go ahead. And I would also say we have a very busy schedule today, primarily because of that hearing. If you've submitted written testimony, if you could summarize, it would be helpful. Thank you.
Parker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Emily Trussell. I'm the Sexual Assault Services Coordinator at Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service, and I'm also a co-chair of the Marion County Human Trafficking Task Force. I'm here today representing Mid-Valley as an advocate, and we serve victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and human trafficking in Marion County. I'm here today to speak on behalf of House Bill 2714 and be a voice for the victims that we work with in support of this bill. As we know, prostitution objectifies women and children in our communities, and this creates a power dynamic in which the Johns, the purchasers, have the social and economic power and control in that relationship. I hear stories from the women and children that I work with about the abuse that they receive in their vulnerable positions that they are in. These Johns are targeting and abusing that power that they have over them. The vast majority of prostitutes are lured into prostitution through force, fraud, and coercion. They are the victims that are being put out there, and these Johns are targeting them and their vulnerabilities. We have heard stories and instances of Johns who are soliciting girls and young girls, very young girls, around schools, in shopping malls. They are targeting them in homeless shelters. They are targeting these individuals who they know are very vulnerable, and it is very much an environment in which they are preying on those vulnerabilities. I hear from the women that they feel powerless as the Johns are forcing them to engage in their sexual fantasies, that they feel they have no options to say no. This is very much a human rights violation. I ask you to support this bill. I think that the separation of the crime of prostitution from the crime of patronizing a prostitute sends a huge message to these women that they are the victims, and it identifies that somebody has taken advantage in exploiting them. I also would like to also highlight a second point in the bill that holds them more accountable, and that they are not allowed to use the excuse that they did not know that the person that they were soliciting sex from was a minor. That is also very important and sends a strong message that this behavior is not acceptable in Oregon. I believe that Johns used lots of excuses for their behavior, but it is not an excuse for them to say they did not know that this person was a minor. And that is very important in addressing the demand side of this industry. And I just want to thank you so much for this opportunity and know that on behalf of victims and survivors in our state, that this is an important step forward for them. And I thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Shoshone Thomas-Sweet, Rep. Barker, Rep. Krieger. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Christian Values. I represent Oregon's Christian community and a coalition of partnering groups from across the state of Oregon, from as far away as Coos Bay and Seaside. We helped host the rally that you may have noticed this January 11th, where 150 people came to the state capitol steps on National Human Trafficking Awareness Day in order to call your attention to the problem that we're trying to combat here with human trafficking. And I'm proud to say that Governor Kitzhaber that day signed into law a proclamation against human trafficking. I'd like to focus on just one aspect of the law here today. I know we're running short of time, but specifically this $20,000 number. Many people at first blush feel that this is an excessive punishment and that it is a draconian and really kind of an extremely punitive measure for it is simply a short sexual act. And I want to counter that notion. The Bible is very clear that the punishment should fit the crime. In this case, the crime of forcing oneself on an underage child has lasting, significant damage to that person over the course of their life. It is not a short 15-minute or half-hour exercise. The person who is raped for money and sold for money is going to be facing significant psychological, emotional damage the rest of their life. They'll have to have counseling and therapy in order to become whole. They're likely to face alcohol and drug abuse. They're much more likely to have their children end up in the foster care system. They're more likely to end up in the criminal justice system, and they will have long-lasting negative effects. In this case, $20,000 is in fact a small fee to pay for damaging another human being for decades to come. And I'd like the members of this committee to take that into consideration when they review that number and when they hopefully push this bill onto the floor of the House. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions to this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. I don't have anybody else testifying on this bill. Anybody else has signed up? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2714. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3100. And I'd like to call Representative Clem, please.
Chair, members of committees, Representative Bill 3100 comes to you from Representative Clem. It requires that a person plead not guilty except consenting and file with the court a report from a psychologist who has been certified by the Oregon Health Authority. Chair, members of committee, it also says that if the crime that you've been charged with is a misdemeanor, that you will be treated in the community and not go to the state hospital.
Thank you. Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, it's nice to be in front of your committee members. So the state hospital is in my district. It's the largest employer in my district. The patients who live there are my constituents. And I, when I got elected, got assigned to be on a special committee dealing with issues around the state hospital. And they've been going on for a long time, as many people know and have read repeatedly in the Oregonian. Representative Tomei has been active in this issue for a long time. We served on that committee together. So one of the things I did, I think it was the summer of 08, was go job shadow a worker there. And I didn't tell anybody I was going. And I just went there. And I did. The employee knew who I was. But nobody else knew who I was. Administration didn't know. The other people didn't know. And I was just in blue jeans and a T-shirt. And I came out of there with some very strong feelings about the state hospital. I had heard all the reports. I had been on the committee and heard all the reports. I'd heard why the feds were investigating it, what the issues were. But somebody came up to the dais in those committee hearings and said, "So you've got to go see it for yourself. You're never going to understand all these reports." So I went and went out there for a day. And this bill is a product of that day. Although other members were working on the same thing, and the reset cabinet recommended this exact same thing, and I'll tell you essentially what I experienced that made me come to this conclusion, that we have to have better controls on the front end of who gets in the state hospital and who doesn't. It was clear to me that there were patients there who, much like the famous movie about the state hospital, probably shouldn't be there. Maybe never should have been there in the first place. They certainly shouldn't be there anymore. They don't have a treatable mental illness, if they ever did. So the question was, you know, was it a plea bargain that got them there and there wasn't somebody appropriate looking at them? Were they recovered and they're stuck there and they can't get out? And now they're largely well, but they're not happy to still be there, and they are causing problems for the other patients, to put it mildly. So, I mean, there were, and I'm not going to get into any specific genders or anything else, but there were patients who, it was clear to me, consume resources massively past what we can afford, unless somehow it's going to turn their life around. And in talking to medical professionals about some of these patients, it's not going to change. And they had been a few times sent to Department of Corrections and then back. Talked to my DA many times about how come every time this person beats somebody, you don't try them and send them back to DOC. Said, well, they'll maybe end up back in the state hospital again. And you know, we're talking several $100,000 you know, per year. I don't know. Somebody said 217. I thought it was 100 and something. But getting treatment at DOC for your mental illness, if there is even a treatment for the particular situation, versus being in the hospital, is a huge cost driver for the state. Being in the community, when you shouldn't be back in the hospital anymore, you're no longer at risk, you've largely been treated, and you need to get out and be treated in a community setting of some kind versus still staying in the state hospital, huge cost driver for the state of Oregon. But more importantly than all that, I saw patients who they're trying to get group therapy, they're often, you'll see them pacing in the halls, and they're sort of lost in their own world at that time. They're still trying to get better, and they're patients in a hospital. And then there'll be somebody else who, in my view, shouldn't be there, causing problems to the point where the therapist trying to conduct group therapy is constantly thinking about how last week that person broke two of the three handlers' arms who follow them around on a three-on-one all day long, and that person may go off again at any moment, and how can I conduct group therapy when somebody's about to attack every other patient and the staff, you know, five yards down the hall. It's very difficult to focus and even work. And employees there can get attacked and beaten. And I saw lots of pictures from people of, oh, here's me a month ago with black eyes and things. And so the question is, what's the appropriate place for some of these people? Some it's out in the community. Some, the really dangerous ones I'm referring to, unless a forensic psychologist or a licensed psychiatrist who understands criminal behavior versus mental illness has said they should be in the state hospital, in my view, they should be in prison. They shouldn't be in the hospital because they're not a patient anymore. They've committed crimes, and if there's nothing we can do for them to help them as a patient, they should be in prison where you can lock the door and then give them whatever services you possibly can there. But if there's nothing we can do to help them, we can't afford to spend that kind of money. If we can help them, that's where they should be, the state hospital, because that's what it's supposed to be, a hospital. But there are people there who should not be there in one way or the other. So what this bill does, and you'll hear all the details, it says at the front end, before you can, in part of a plea arrangement or a sentencing arrangement, send somebody there, it's a new certification and credentialing requirement around the professionals who are judging whether these people actually have a treatable mental illness or whether they should be at a state hospital. Can they be helped there? Because right now we don't have a strong enough standard at all. And this would put somebody who's a professional in forensic psychology or psychiatry in a position to say, yes, there's something we can do for this person, send them to the state hospital, or no, there's nothing we can do. And in fact, I'm not even sure, in some cases, I believe this person, I don't believe their story. I don't believe what they're telling us about their episode that now no longer seems to even be present in their, you know, in their overall mental health situation, and they should go to jail. And so, you know, it's a seesaw. There's some people, again, both sides. Some who should go to jail, some who should are in the state hospital, and they should be out in the community getting help because they're better already and they're stuck there. And that's a big part of the federal report and why we may eventually get sued, hopefully not, but why we're trying to avoid lawsuits that will cost the state an ungodly amount of money to remedy this issue. The rebuild is only part of it. Things like this are the other really key part of it. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, unlike the last bill, which the solution is real apparent in my brain, this one I've struggled with because I never did go to the state hospital, the old one. I regret that. But when I was a freshman, I went to the state prison. And the doctor there was saying, I got people here that belong in the state hospital. So I'm struggling with this, representative. I appreciate what you did, and I believe everything you said, but I don't really know what to do, to be quite frank with you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I think that you'll find that jurisdictional issues and the whole system are at issue. This is just one start. This is just at the court level before they even get to prison. Let's make sure it's not just a psychologist in the county, whether they know anything about forensic or not. Let's make sure that they actually know something about forensic psychology. Because, again, once they're in these other places, it's pretty hard to move them around now once they're under certain jurisdictions. So we really have to deal with it at the trial level the charging them level and understanding whether they actually can even stand trial for what they did or not. Because once they're there, as you described, it's not easy at all. And it's going to take a lot bigger policy discussion on how to rearrange, PSRB jurisdiction, all that kind of stuff.
Mr. Taylor?
Chair, members of the committee, one of the difficulties here, if a person's found guilty but for insanity, goes to state hospital, and if the state hospital determines they're not suffering from mental disease or defect, they will be released. You cannot try them again because of double jeopardy. And there have been instances of this. So you've had people who've been convicted of murder, found guilty but for insanity, gone to the state hospital, and the in-depth diagnosis is they're not suffering from mental disease or defect, they're free.
Chair, if I might just add to that briefly, all the neighbors who live around the state hospital are in my district too, and every time somebody walks out of there, I hear about it. And sometimes it's completely understandable and you can figure out what happened and medical issues, something. This one guy, he got his girlfriend to smuggle in bolt cutters inside of a hollowed out DVD player, and then he had his buddies open up their trench coats and block the fence so he could cut his way out. And I'm just thinking, if you have that level of complex planning, I'm not sure we need to pay for you to get medical treatment anymore. Maybe you should be somewhere else, where we can really keep a hold of you, or you've been cured and you've figured out a lot of stuff in life, including a girlfriend and a scheme and your buddies, and maybe it's time to put you back in under some other kind of supervision that's not several hundred thousand dollars a year.
Representative Hicks.
Thanks. I'm hearing the problem, and I just want to weigh in that there's two general points at which the court makes a decision as to the mental capacity of a person. The first is whether they're insane right now. Aid and assist. Can they actually stand trial? Can they be prosecuted? And that's one independent question, frankly. And then after they're determined to be okay now, which can have come about for a number of reasons, maybe they're back balanced out on their meds, they've been in the jail, maybe they're on a program now, whatever. Then they go back and they get tried for what happened back then when they committed the offense. See, and so they can be, quite frankly, found to be okay right now because they've been sitting in the jail for 6 months on their meds, but they were not okay at the time of the crime, in which case they're found guilty but for insanity of the alleged offense and sent to the hospital. So, and I'm only saying that for the purpose of saying it, but I mean, I think a good context for us to be going forward to hear the rest of the testimony. And if you have a reaction to that, by all means.
Mr. Chair, or Vice Chair Hicks, excuse me, it seems like somebody who's trained in forensic psychology and psychiatry would have a better sense of how to judge what happened backwards than somebody who's a standard psychologist in that county who that's not their expertise, is really criminal psychology and what was someone's state of mind with a criminal intent or not, and what was mental illness and what was... It seems like if that's your practice, you'd have a better way to gauge some of those backwards-looking questions than if you're generally a psychologist who's dealing with, Representative Schaffler and I just going in to talk about all of our problems.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Richard Harris and Mary Claire Buckley, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Richard Harris, and I am the Assistant Director in the Oregon Health Authority for Addictions and Mental Health, and I thank you for the opportunity to discuss HB 3100 here. I'd like to thank Representative Clem for bringing this bill forward. We think that it as an opportunity to clarify some issues and help better manage the front door into the forensic mental health system in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
The entry point to the forensic mental health system is primarily through the state, Oregon State Hospital. In 2010, the average daily number of persons in the forensic programs at the state hospital was 446, which is 75% of the total average daily census at the Oregon State Hospital. You can see that the hospital, by and large, has a predominantly forensic population. And they're made up of both individuals under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board and also those there that are either being evaluated or helping to remedy their mental illness so they can, in fact, aid and assist in their own defense. The decision whether to place an individual in the state hospital for forensic services is frequently made without sufficient information to consider other options. In addition, the current statutory framework lacks the mandate to explore other dispositional alternatives. Finally, the forensic evaluations upon which courts across the state rely on making these critical decisions lack consistency in both content and quality. Currently, there is neither a standardized format nor a uniform utilization of assessment tools required for these evaluations. AMH, in collaboration with the Psychiatric Security Review Board, we would like to support the language in this bill. The concept will improve the quality of information provided to the court in making certain judicial determinations. The concept also provides the court with additional direction and a process for assessing the necessary insanity of GEI. The provisions in this concept will contribute to the goal of providing individuals appropriate mental health treatment in the appropriate place for the appropriate length of time while maintaining public safety and reserving the valuable state hospital resource for those individuals needing that level of care and supervision. And I would like now to turn the remainder of this over to Mary Claire Buckley from the Psychiatric Security Review Board.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Barker, Krieger, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the executive director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. I would like to just walk you through the specific elements of this bill and what the pieces are that we believe will help to improve this system. There are four basic elements to this bill. The first is the certification of forensic evaluators. The second deals with the placement of defendants who were found unable to aid and assist in their own defense. The third is the disposition of persons found guilty except for insanity of a misdemeanor. And finally, the fourth element deals with the mandatory community evaluation of persons found guilty except for insanity of a Class C felony. With regards to the first, what we hope to do with this bill is to establish a training program for those psychologists and psychiatrists who do evaluations for purposes of establishing either a finding of an inability to aid and assist or whether somebody qualifies for the insanity defense here in Oregon. The bill indicates that Addictions and Mental Health Division, in consultation or in collaboration with the board, would develop rules to certify these evaluators to conduct such evaluations, and also would establish by rule standardized format for those evaluations so that there's more uniformity in the contents of these reports. The purpose of that particular element of this bill is to instill confidence and some consistency in this part of the system. Secondly, for those who are found unable to aid and assist, this bill would have only those who are dangerous to self or others being sent to the state hospital. Others who don't meet that level by the court's determination would remain in the community and receive those restorative services in a community setting by local mental health treatment providers. Thirdly, the with regards to misdemeanors who are found guilty except for insanity of a crime, they would no longer be placed under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. What would happen to those individuals is the court would determine whether they were dangerous to self or others, and if so, there is the ability to have those individuals committed to the hospital for care and treatment, but the decision as to when they would leave the hospital would be in the hands of the hospital, so that if they were sent there and they were treated and either no longer were suffering from that mental illness or were no longer a substantial danger to others, the hospital could release them with notice to the court. And the final element of this bill is the that we would require that any individual who is found guilty except for insanity of a Class C felony would be required to have an evaluation by a community mental health agency who currently works with the board for this very purpose, for determining release status for people who are leaving the hospital. We would use those same providers to evaluate these individuals at the time they're in the court to decide whether, in fact, they could be adequately controlled and treated without going to the state hospital. There would still be the option that if they needed hospital level of care, they could be sent, but at least there would be a mandatory evaluation for the court to consider whether, in fact, hospital level of care was necessary. I will tell you that historically, we used to get probably on an annual basis 25% of the persons placed under the board were put on conditional release. In the last 5 years, for whatever reason, I couldn't tell you, that has dropped to about 13 or 14%. So we believe that with this bill in requiring somebody to at least assess that, that we may well be able to avoid sending persons who don't need a hospital level of care to that facility, thereby saving those beds for people who better need them. So those are the four aspects to this bill, we think that they would advance the interest that we all have in assuring that the appropriate treatment is provided to the appropriate people at the appropriate place for the appropriate length of time. And I thank you for the opportunity and would answer any questions you have.
I think you have any questions. Okay, so Representative
Hicks. I don't want to dwell on this because we have a lot of time, but I continue to have the concerns that we talked about the other day, and so maybe we'll touch base again as time goes on about the bill, unless you want to address them now in terms of how the rural impact, some of the other things we talked about. But beyond that, I wonder if you could tell us if you happen to know whether there is a cost or an average cost of the initial exam currently, the current approach. Do we know how much this is costing? Is there a figure out there?
I believe that the cost for the evaluations presently is borne by the Indigent Defense Fund.
Mr. Chair, may I? Thank you. Yeah, and I'd like to know if we could touch base about that, perhaps for the whole committee, because this is ultimately going to have a fiscal impact, and so we do need to know that number to make an informed decision. You know what I mean? I mean, that's okay. Thank you.
Co-chairs and Representative Hicks, we anticipate that this evaluation that we're talking about for the Class C felonies would not be of the same level or extent as the ones that are done for a determination of the insanity defense or aid and assist. This would just be to determine whether they could be adequately controlled and treated in the community. Maybe a less comprehensive evaluation, because they could rely on some of the information that has been provided by the certified evaluator that's done those evaluations.
Are we just talking about the post-conviction evaluation as to whether the court should? We're not just talking about that, right? Because what happens after that? I guess I said the court weighs in twice. The court does weigh in three times on the capacity of the defendant. Are they able to aid and assist as they're standing there in the court after they've committed the crime? And then the fact finder, be it the jury if they take it to trial or the court, will either will make a finding. Actually, I don't think they're able to accept a plea unless they've made a finding in regards to the insanity of the defendant, the capacity of the defendant at the time of the crimes. So that's number two. And then number three, after at sentencing, the court is going to decide whether to, I mean, they are going to be sentenced to PSRB if they're found to have not had mental capacity for the statute. Then the court will decide, number three, whether to grant conditional release, which is oftentimes what the defense moves for, or to commit to the state hospital under PSRB jurisdiction either way, which is oftentimes what the state moves for. And so I guess there would potentially be a third analysis in there. We'd basically have three potential analysis points here. And so are we talking about a forensically qualified analyst for each time? Or what? Because it's going to have a fiscal impact and a lot of other implications, and so I just want to get to this.
Coaches and Representative Hicks, the evaluation that I'm referring to for Class C felonies would be by a community mental health agency, and some of those are done by case managers in consultation with this psychiatrist that works with that particular mental health agency. That's a different type of evaluation than the ones you're talking about with regards to whether, in fact, they qualify for the insanity defense or whether they are able to aid and assist their attorney. So those are done by the first part. We would have the certification for people who perform those. The one for the Class C would be just by a community mental health agency and would not necessarily be by a psychiatrist or psychologist, although some communities do utilize those in determining whether their agency is willing to accept our clients.
Okay, thanks for clarifying.
Representative Shawford.
Yeah, this may be question may be part of a bigger conversation, but we're talking about the mental fitness or lack thereof of someone going into prison. What happens if they're in their 10 years, and while they're in their 10 years, they fall prey to mental illness and they cannot take care of themselves? What do we do with those folks? We just cut them loose? They've served their time. They've fallen prey to mental illness while in our custody. What do we do with them?
If they're still in need of mental health services at this hospital level, the hospital would petition to have a civil commitment made. Mm. If not, they would be discharged to the community.
Thank you.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I don't know if you have the information off the top of your head, but it would be useful for me to put this in context of how Oregon's system functions compared with other systems. Particularly, I'd be interested in learning of any systems that are deemed by the professionals to be most effective. Certainly, other states deal with the challenge of mentally incapacitated perpetrators, as well as people who are maybe not criminally guilty but are facing mental challenges. Are there states who have successfully established model ways of addressing this issue?
Co-chairs and Representative Nolan, not to toot Oregon's own horn, but I will tell you that the Psychiatric Security Review Board has been considered the national model for the management and treatment of persons who are found or deemed either guilty except for insanity or not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect throughout the country. In fact, the state of Washington attempted last session to adopt Oregon's model, but because of fiscal concerns weren't able to implement the whole process, so they started a psychiatric review panel within their hospital setting. But, there are certainly different states handle their insanity acquittees in different ways. But
And if I might follow up,
please.
I'd be happy to take this conversation offline if I could get one more question. When you say, and I'm delighted to hear that Oregon is perceived through its Psychiatric Security Review Board to be at the leading edge, what's the threshold criterion on which we seem to be most successful? Is it a system that most effectively preserves the dignity of the individual and the safety of the community? Is it the lowest cost system? On what continuum are we best?
Representative Nolan, I would say the former, that given the board's mandate to protect the public and the current recidivism rate, it is, you know, considered a model because of the low recidivism rate, as well as the ability to conditionally release people to the community. A lot of states don't have a conditional release component to their insanity treatment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Kocher.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Juan, thank you.
Thank you. Do we have, we're altering what evidence a defendant can introduce at trial, or at least that's the way I read it. And so I'm just wondering if we have a comfort level that altering that presentation of evidence will meet a constitutional standard. And if we don't have a comfort level with that, have we considered what the cost will be to run this up to the Oregon Supreme Court?
Co-chairs, Representative Juan, I don't believe that we've, if anything, we've improved it, I believe, by requiring that these individuals who perform the evaluations are certified in forensic, because that's a specialty within, you know, the psychiatric or psychological community. So the, right now, evaluations are required. It's just currently by any licensed psychologist or psychiatrist. So what we're doing is actually making that even more explicit, so that these individuals who are trained in the applicable law in Oregon would utilize that for purposes of their decision making.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I don't disagree with anything you've said. The devil's advocate position is that we are erecting another barrier that reduces the number of evaluators and creates a government-imposed obligation on the, and limitation on who can come in and testify on behalf of the defendant. And I'm not well-versed enough in constitutional law or criminal law to know whether this is a, raises red flags. So my question is, you know, have you guys looked at that, and
yes,
and what do the constitutional scholars tell us?
Chairs Baker and Krieger.
This doesn't limit what testimony can be brought in
court. It only says that for the determination in the aid and assist ability to participate in their defense, that we want to know what their mental health status is. We want to determine in some detail their ability to do that. So we're really assessing their capacity there. And then in the case of the evaluation to be considered guilty, except insane, again, it's establishing what the mental status of the individual is, and using standard tools and trained individuals to do that with. So it doesn't preclude that other individuals may be called into a case to offer opinions about the person's physical condition or any other special need that they may have.
Mr. Chair, follow up, please. Thank you. But with respect, I'm looking at Section 1. And may not introduce evidence on the issue of insanity unless, and then it goes down and it says you have to have a report of a psychiatric or psychological evaluation conducted by a certified evaluator. So it does prevent evidence on the part of the defendant under this limited circumstance. And so my question is, again, what do the constitutional scholars tell us about whether we are likely to receive challenges, whether we are likely to win those challenges, and what the effect would be if, goodness forbid, we have 35 inmates that were prosecuted under this new law who are now looking at being released and their convictions overturned, and us having to go back to trial again solely because we wanted a new certification on the part of the state.
Representative Wand, I believe that language says that whatever happens in terms of individuals that may be asked to testify, at least you have to have a certified evaluation done as part of whatever the record is. As far as to what may or may not be considered constitutional, I think that we would make the assumption when we're setting the standard for these that they are following the standards that are used and recognized nationally as well as local forensic standards.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Coach.
Thank you, and thank you. Those are excellent questions, and I believe we're going to have somebody later that might be able to answer those. So thank you, panel. Next, I'll call Jan Kroll, Dr. Henderson, and Chief Rubenstein. Again, I remind people that we are kind of time limited. We have a lot of people like to testify today, and we're trying to get everybody in. So, especially if you have written testimony, if you could just give us the summary of that, we will read that information. You can go in any order you'd like, but please just identify yourself for the record.
Hi, Chair Barker and Chair Krieger, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Robin Henderson. I am, sorry about that, learning how to use this iPad, going green like the rest of you. So we put our notes on a little sheet here that makes it a little bit easier for me to handle. I am Director of Behavioral Health Services and Health Integration Project at St. Charles Health System in Bend, Oregon. I am here today to speak to you from two different groups of folks, so I'll address them each separately because they both have separate things that they would like to bring to talk about. First, I will speak as a member of the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board. The Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board supports House Bill 3100 and encourages you to pass this piece of legislation out of committee. We have heard from the PSRB, from staff, from patients, and truly feel that significant reform is needed. The patients that we heard from in our committee in our board hearings over the last few meetings have been very eloquent and consistently described waiting for assessments and care plans, delays, and additional or unclear requirements that sometimes needlessly lengthen their stays. Additionally, many express frustration at only being able to apply to one placement at a time. So you can imagine this. You get ready to go for your placement, and you got to pick that one, and you can submit your application for that one and wait for them to say, yeah, I'm good with that too, and then you have to interview and go through that process. And if there's no bed, you have to wait then and apply to a different one. You can't apply to multiple places at one time. By the same token, we heard from providers who were frustrated with empty beds. I talked to somebody yesterday who said, you know, we had an empty bed in our adult foster home for a year. And that level of frustration is very difficult to deal with. Additionally, many expressed frustration that sometimes things outside their control would contribute to, you know, the mitigating circumstances that had nothing to do with their mental health condition or why they were there that really extended their length of time for a long period of time. We also want to show our support for the amendments that will be brought forward by NAMI. And I was thinking that I'd be testifying after NAMI so that you'd have a better reference point. I will defer that to Chris Bonoff, who will explain to you a little bit more about NAMI's amendments. But suffice it to say, those amendments address issues related to standardized assessments that both take into account both the mental health acuity of the patient and the risk level, and looking at some of those types of factors on a consistent basis, so that we're standardly looking forward and looking to how we can move folks out. We know in the treatment of mental illness that folks, when they start to get to a point of recovery and begin to embrace recovery, that if we leave them at too high of a level of care for too long, that begins to deteriorate. And all of the hope that they have and the adequate amount of fear that they have and the whole idea that they're moving ready to go forward in recovery really begins to decay if they can't move on and get out there and start to use those skills and move forward. And that's when hopelessness sets in and people are less and less likely to be successful when they leave. We need to find that balance between having them there long enough to make sure they're there and being able to send them out into the community at that right time. And we're not there yet, clearly. Some of the folks that the board heard from were ready to go, are ready to go, and now they're starting to develop a high level of frustration because due to system errors and things that are happening on our end, they can't be going out into the community. NAMI's amendments create savings by moving people out of the high-cost Oregon State Hospital beds and into community-based treatment. We feel those savings that are realized can be reinvested in the community system of care and improve the care that helps support people when they're back in their home community. We also reserve the right to bring you other amendments at a later time. There was a lot of robust discussion about NAMI's amendments on our listserv this last week, and we have some other ideas that we may bring back to you at a later time. But we do support House Bill 3100, and we support NAMI's amendments. I also want to take off my hat and put on my other hat, speaking for the Oregon Psychological Association. You heard testimony talking about the forensic psychological evaluators that are part of House Bill 3100. We fully support that. We feel that it standardizes and provides a competency base that will spread throughout the state. I know there are concerns. I heard the concerns about rural providers. Fortunately, we have many rural providers who have been in our forensic pool and our legislative committee who fully support this and feel that we can meet that need and can work together to make that happen. But it's more important that we have competent forensic evaluators in place and get the best quality assessments that we can. The Oregon Psychological Association also supports NAMI's amendments, and the overall interest is to move towards discharging stable patients as soon as they don't meet the criteria for further inpatient stay. We do that in the private community all of the time. Hospitalization needs to be based on both the mental illness acuity and the risk, and we're happy to work with folks to pick the types of standardized assessments and evaluation tools. That's our area of expertise, and we stand ready to help. PSRB folks, and we have some of the folks who provide evaluations for the PSRB looking over these two bills, the bill and the amendment, they often note that barriers to discharge are a lack of completed assessments. If we come to a standardized assessment pool that really takes these things into account, we can facilitate treatment planning, recovery, and ultimately discharge. And it would be helpful, if it would be helpful, we'd be happy to help with that. The overall goal, we feel, of this bill and of NAMI's amendments is to work towards the more timely and efficient effective assessment of PSRB patients with careful attention to these patients' treatment, risk management, and discharge needs. The goal is also to move towards the discharge of PSRB patients as soon as they are deemed ready for community placement, which needs to evolve from its current state based on the available information. And the only way we're going to do that is to reinvest dollars into the system. Thank you very much, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. And Dr. the reason you got moved up the list because you came over 100 miles. We tried to have people.
You were too kind. Thank you. Thank you, Representative. I appreciate that. It is snowy in the past if you're driving home tonight.
Yeah. He is a cool guy.
I've been trying to figure out how to do that, so I've been watching you closely. I want to listen to my curse, but I'm still on paper. For the record, my name is Jan Krall. I'm the CEO of the Shangri-La Corporation, Chairs Barker and Krieger, members of the House Judiciary Committee. I'm here today as a representative of the Oregon Residential Providers Association, ORPA, not of the of ORA, as some of you come to know me to testify. ORPA is a consortium of mental health providers who manage residential treatment programs across our state. Our mission is to promote effective and efficient mental health residential services throughout the state of Oregon. Among the many services that Shangri-La provides is eight residential training homes that we operate in five counties, serving approximately 40 individuals at any particular time. Since 2005, we've served probably over 200 people in those homes, representing a real change in the movement from providing a home-based situation for people to the transition and moving people out of the hospitals. We also note that much of the discussion today is pre-incarceration discussion, and I just wanted to point out that post-incarceration activities are happening within OSCI, and Coffee Creek and Shangri-La has been doing that for about 14 years now, and so there may be something that you want to think about as you try to figure out that question that was put to you before about where PSRB belongs. House ORPA supports House Bill 3100. We support efforts that promote anything that helps community placement become an appropriate alternative for Oregonians in our state, for misdemeanants who and those facing Class C felonies who have pled guilty except for reasons of insanity, or where there are issues of fitness to proceed should the court determine that they're not a danger to themselves or others. As providers of community services, ORPA knows firsthand the benefits of treatment for those people in the community. With the appropriate level of services, the people we work with are able to lead successful and productive lives. We value the role of our state hospital as one critical asset in our community. We also know that many of the people who are or will become patients there can thrive in our residential settings and in other community-based programs given the opportunities. So we're especially pleased to hear the discussion about assessments in communities, removing the trauma and the cost from possibly at least part of the state hospital role. Furthermore, we are also providers of services to PSRB clients. We recognize that public safety is a critical component to the work that we do, and ORPA members support and directly participate in efforts to mitigate risk to the community, and we're confident that we can help increase the number of low-risk GEI clients in our community with the proper supports. We believe that that will not result in serious or further public safety concerns. We further recognize that clients who are deemed unable to aid and assist can be adequately supported in the community with proper supports. And in fact, Shangri-La has developed a program like that in Lane County, yet to be maximized, but nevertheless present. So we believe that that's a very important part of the conversation. We see this as an efficient use of public resources to house individuals in the state hospital if they're not identified as a risk to themselves or others. We expect to see that such individuals can be adequately restored to fitness to proceed while at the same time residing in less restrictive settings than the hospital. And while ORPA supports House Bill 31, we would caution that there is a risk if there are inadequate services. And I've heard many of you address that issue and address the costs associated with those services. And I know that you're well aware of them, and we appreciate that. I have a couple of questions that we would like to suggest that, without seeming presumptuous, because you probably already asked them, but we do want to know what services will be available for those people for the GEI misdemeanants or for those found unable to aid in their and assist while they're waiting. And we want to know something about who will provide the supervision for these individuals to assure that any public safety issues would be addressed. And finally, what would happen to those individuals and within our communities relative to safety and to the human condition if that support is not provided. And I also hear you all talking about that continuum as you're trying to sort all of this out, and I'm very grateful for that. These questions need to be answered as part of the evaluation, and if we can help in any way, of course we will do that. Of course, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you and again want to emphasize our support of House Bill 3100. I alluded to it, but I want to remind you that we've talked a lot about the front door, but there is a back door, and to keep that front door from swinging open, we need to do things to keep the back door, you know, moving people out and not coming back in. So thank you for your time and your consideration and the clearly very thoughtful work that you're doing.
Okay, thank you. Chief?
Barry Barker and Krieger, committee members. My name is Paul Rubenstein. I'm Chief of Police for the City of Cornelius, representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. I'm here to speak in support of this bill. We believe that it's a good first step forward. It addresses issues that need to be addressed. Some of her questions, we've evaluated this. We believe that this does not endanger the public. We believe that the system balances that are in it are there so that we can do our job without endangering the public. And if you have any questions, that's all I have to say.
Well, thank you. Appreciate the brief comments. Any questions? Thank you, panel. Next, call up Jody Britta, Chris Bonoff, and Shannon Pullen. And I'll remind you again, we're getting crunched for time, so if somebody's already said it, you somebody don't need to repeat it. And if you have written testimony, if you could please summarize. And go ahead, any order, just identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Jody Beretta. I'm a deputy district attorney for Marion County, and I'm here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We're generally in support of this bill. We certainly understand the reasons behind wanting to modify some of the PSRB jurisdiction. I'd like to highlight for you some of the things that are particularly important to my association and things that are really necessary if we're going to modify the PSRB jurisdiction. Requiring a certified evaluator,
and will promote consistency and quality of evaluations. I think that that would cause both the bench and prosecutors to rely more readily on those evaluations. It would save very important judicial time as well as indigent resources and state resources because it would reduce the number of contested hearings that we would have. It would hopefully increase accuracy of those evaluations. Of particular importance to the District Attorneys Association is kind of the catch-all provision for misdemeanors. Under this bill, generally, misdemeanors would no longer be under the jurisdiction of PSRB. But importantly is that it has the catch-all for people who would present a substantial danger to the community, and that's very important. In this line of work, I've come to know that there are very dangerous people who may be not legally culpable because they have mental defect or disease. However, they're very dangerous to the community. People who commit misdemeanor assaults, public indecencies, statutory sex offenses. And this bill allows for a judge to make the determination under the facts of each case whether the person constitutes a substantial danger and allows them to commit them to the hospital. That's a very necessary component of this bill. I would also urge, I haven't seen the amendments, but I know there was some talk of defining statutorily substantial danger. We would be against that. I do not think that a statutory definition would help. I think that it would actually take the power away from the judge in evaluating the particulars of each person's danger and the facts of each case. Also very important would be in this bill, it continues to allow the jurisdiction of PSRB to be the statutory maximum. That's very significant because it's important to keep people, you've heard them referred to as patients, and the need for the actors needs to be met, but important to us is protecting the community, and doing that, we need to keep them under the jurisdiction of PSRB for the longest possible time, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Chris Bonneff. I'm the executive director of NAMI Oregon, the Oregon chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are in support of 3100 with a concept that we offered as an amendment late last week that I understand is still being drafted into language. And just as testimony has, particularly Representative Clem and others have identified, there's two doors to this institution. One's the front door. Are people who need to be there actually there? And there's a back door. Once you don't need that acute level of care, can you get out? 3100, as it stands, only addresses the front door, which is only half the problem. Right now, we have an institution that consumes 55% of all of our mental health spending, and will continue. That percentage will continue to grow as we face capacity challenges. What we are proposing, and that which language will be available soon, and it's very summarized in my written testimony, but is that looking at what actually happens once you've been deemed necessary to be in an institution, what happens to you when you're there, and the process by which you get out. Right now, we don't have a very rational process that is predictable for people who are in the hospital, which is in large part why we are under investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice, which was just here this week, looking at not only what's going on in the hospital, what's going on in the community. What we are proposing is that once patients are admitted to the Oregon State Hospital, that a timely assessment is given of their clinical necessity, that that with everything else that accompanies them before that, other assessments, informs patient-centered treatment plans, and that at regular intervals, people are reassessed and treatment plans reviewed, and progress, clinical progress is actually measured. That's something that you would assume goes on at the hospital on a regular basis, but it does not. That as you start measuring progress against your treatment goal and start reaching your treatment goals, as you get close to, as they say, ready to place, ready to leave the institution, when you don't need hospital level care, discharge planning actually starts occurring so that a community is engaged in figuring out what support services and what treatment need an individual needs and what risk they may pose to community safety, so that we're taking into account and balancing both treatment need and support services and risk. And then as that planning occurs, as the goals are finally met and someone has maximized treatment at a hospital level of care, a discharge actually occurs. So as was alluded to earlier, you'll have people on a ready-to-place list, and they'll stay on that list for some significant period of time. What we're proposing is that there is a window at which that discharge needs to occur, and someone needs to leave the hospital into the most appropriate setting, again, based on both their mental health and support services need and an assessment of public safety. We firmly believe that this is a precious resource that we have here, and it needs to be used and viewed as a precious resource. It needs to be accessible to people who need it. And once you don't need that resource, the state needs to invest its dollars. Right now we're spending in excess of $200,000 a year per patient per year. We need to be using those resources at less costly, more effective placements, whether they're, you describe them as out in the community, what I'd like to see them as out of institutions that are centralized, that are big box institutions. So that could be secure residential treatment. It could be residential treatment. It could be supervised in the community and supported housing. But what it should be is an appropriate placement, again, based on their mental health needs, on what support services they need, and based on public safety. Thank you.
Hello. Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger and members of the Judiciary Committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Shannon Pullen. I'm a family member of someone at the Oregon State Hospital under the jurisdiction of the PSRB. I'm also a NAMI member, and I sit on the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board. I, too, want to voice my support for House Bill 3100. However, my concern is that because it doesn't apply to anyone who's currently in the hospital, that I would like to also voice my support for the amendments that NAMI is going to be putting forward. I think the amendments give an opportunity to give the same consideration that we'll be giving new patients to the patients who are currently at the hospital. I believe it will also give an opportunity to provide, to promote recovery and to provide the appropriate level of care based on an individual patient's needs. There's a lot of momentum around the state hospital right now. I think a lot of good things are happening. We have a new, we're getting a new building. The advisory board is very engaged with the new hospital leadership and staff support. I think we can truly transform the organization into a world-class organization. But I don't think we'll be able to do that until we address the things that people face as they're trying to get out of the hospital under the PSRB. At times, the missions of the PSRB and the Oregon State Hospital are at odds. The role of the PSRB as a gatekeeper and a watchdog for the safety of the community is a necessary one, but its shared role in patient recovery needs to be emphasized. Recovery and punishment are competing objectives. When my brother was originally sent to the state hospital, I was so hopeful that he would finally get the medical care and treatment that he has long needed. And I think a lot of family members view their loved one's situation in this way at the start. Families are so desperate to get help for their loved one that even having them locked away can seem like a positive step. The deal that is made is that the patient will give up their freedom, and in return, the state will make their best efforts to help them and not punish them for past actions. A few years ago, the state hospital determined that my brother was ready for conditional release. We arrived at his PSRB hearing with a sense of hope and optimism. I'd hoped that my brother was finally getting the treatment that he needed. I'd hoped that he wasn't going to be spending the next 20 years of his life at that hospital. Whatever hope I had arrived with quickly evaporated as we walked through the door. It was clear my brother had transformed from patient to criminal. His PSRB hearing focused mainly on a rehash of his troubled past, with little weight given to the progress he had made, his indications of current stability, or the opinions and findings of the medical professionals charged with his care. The process itself was very demoralizing. My brother has once again started the discharge planning process, and to our family's dismay, he's allowed to pick only one residential program to apply to. The choice for many in this situation is to pick the place they hope will have an opening first, even if it means they're far from their family and their natural support, the very support that they will need to be successful in the community once they're out. And despite his excitement about the possibility of getting out of the hospital, my brother is very concerned about having to face another PSRB hearing and a likely scenario of a denial to his request for community placement. It says in Proverbs 18, verse 14, "The spirit of a man can endure his sickness, but a broken spirit, who can bear?" People currently under the PSRB have no hope. People under the PSRB can spend years doing all they need to heal and recover, only to find that it's never enough.
They learn quickly that the system views them as dangerous to others, based more on their past actions than on actual current condition. They learn quickly they have no real recourse, and it becomes all too easy to give up. So I'm here today to ask this committee, to help give hope to those people currently at Oregon State Hospital under the PSRB. It is possible to balance the treatment needs of the patient against the safety needs of society. And it is possible for the PSRB to provide recovery-oriented support and be protective of those under their jurisdiction. By passing House Bill 3100 with the proposed amendments that NAMI and other advocacy groups are putting forward, you will be taking the first step. Thank you for your time and consideration today.
Bob Jean Depp, Jeff Hetherington, and Christina McMahar.
That's the wrong.
I'm sorry?
That's the wrong agenda.
Oh, wrong. I'm sorry. Christina. No. And Patty O'Sullivan, please.
You ready to get? Good afternoon. Co-chairs Krieger and Barker and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the director for Polk County Mental Health. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. The program, AOCMHP as we call it, is a unified voice of local governments which are accountable by statute for the well-being of people with mental illness, addictions, and developmental disabilities. Thank you for taking time to review my comments related to this House Bill 3100. You've heard a lot of testimony, and I'm just going to go to some of the highlights that haven't been mentioned previously. Alternative placements in the community, which can be matched on a case-by-case basis with the needs of each individual, can often cost just half or one-third the cost of the amount. Federal law prohibits Medicaid matching for state hospital services. And even 16-bed community facilities that cost close to the same amount as a hospital are a better option because the state can receive a federal Medicaid match. That's very important in this economic climate we have here. The potential impacts, someone mentioned earlier, over $200,000 a year. It's about $212,000 a year to take care of a patient in a hospital. If a bill like this bill had been drafted and passed in the 2009 session, the results would have been significant. Would have had freed up 12 beds of new capacity at OSH, thank you. Would have created more hope for these individuals in their recovery because of the ability to live in the community, be supported by their family, and learn skills to live more independently. It would have freed up in a range of $250 million each biennium by treating individuals in settings that cost up to one-third less than OSH and for the services that can often be matched by Fed money, about a ratio of 1.7 to 1. Our association wants to thank Representative Clem for sponsoring this bill, and we would also like to recognize the efforts of Bill Taylor for bringing together a diverse work group of stakeholders that have made this across-the-board support. And lastly, we'd like to recognize the work of Richard Harris at AMH and Mary Claire Buckley of PSRB for drafting the bill HB 3100. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems and a committee that resides within the Association of the Oregon Psychiatric Inpatient Council. We support House Bill 3100. We also support the amendments brought forward by NAMI. I'm going to just briefly tell you about a piece of the system that hasn't really been mentioned here. The association represents 13 acute psychiatric hospitals that are out in communities, both in the metro area but also located in southern Oregon on the coast and in central Oregon. People that enter our acute psychiatric hospitals they come either voluntarily, they come from law enforcement, or they come from the emergency room predominantly, and they're having some sort of a psychotic break. They need help instantly. Our units are not meant to be long-term units. They're not meant for people to be there to get long-term treatment and to be engaged in long-term programming. what's happening is that people are getting bogged down there because of the wait list to get into the hospital. So our interest in this is to free up the front door to get people from these acute psychiatric hospitals into the state hospital if that's what they need, and to free up the back door so that there are beds available. Some of our units have had people there 60 to 90 days, which is just not appropriate for these folks. The Oregon Psychiatric Inpatient Council, OPIC, was created 10 years ago to look at this very issue and to also look at some issues of funding. I'm here today, sadly, to say that those issues are still alive here today. They have not been taken care of. This is an opportunity, this bill, and hopefully the amendments, which do have some stricter timelines in there, and we support that. To finally do something, the time is right. Out of chaos comes change, and we are in a chaotic time. So I really encourage you to look at the bill, look at the amendments, and we fully support them so that our units out there can do the job that they're intended to do and not do the job of the Oregon State Hospital. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. I will refer you to my written testimony because I know time is short.
I appreciate that.
I just want to make a couple quick points, and one is that from our perspective, as working to effectuate the rights of all the people in the mental health system, is that particularly given our present fiscal situation, we have to make the best use of the resources that we have in the most efficient and effective way. The bill before you, House Bill 3100, is a very modest reform to dealing with how people get into the forensic programs. We think it's a good step. It doesn't solve all the problems. The problems are very complex. But right now, we do need to take steps forward, and this is a step forward. In terms of a question that was asked a little bit earlier about whether there may be some constitutional defects in terms of limiting the evidence that a criminal defendant can bring forward, I don't profess to be a legal scholar. However, I will opine on this, that the bill as I read it does not limit the evidence that a criminal defendant can bring forward. It requires that they bring forth one piece of evidence, but it does not prohibit them from bringing forward additional evidence. One of the tricky things about this area in general is that insanity defenses are pretty much controlled by state law. There's very little in the way of constitutional direction from the Supreme Court or the U.S. Constitution on this topic. And so as legislators choose to frame the insanity defense in Oregon, that will have a major influence on how it's interpreted. And in my view, at least, the provisions before you, although anything can be challenged, of course, I think this would be upheld in an appellate court.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panel. Mark Nystrom, Chris Lockie, and Rebecca Brewis.
Mr. Chair, do you intend to work these last three bills on the agenda today?
Yeah, it's a work session. We're hoping to do some other bills if you could. I want you to have your full chance to testify. We need your testimony, but if you remember, we're short on time. Thank you.
No problem.
Please go ahead.
Okay. Chairs Barker and Krieger, I appreciate, and committee members, I appreciate your time. My name is Christopher Lockie. I represent the Oregon Psychiatric Association. I'm also the Oregon Health and Science University Chief Psychiatrist at the Oregon State Hospital and Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at OHSU, and I'm here today on behalf of the OPA. We support House Bill 3100, requiring pre-adjudication by evaluations by certified psychologists or psychiatrists. We believe this will help ensure that the people who are actually committed to the hospital under the PSRB are there because they require hospital level of care. We introduced a similar bill in 2007 that would have acquired certification of these evaluators. So the OPA does support this bill, and we look forward to working with AMH in generating those certification procedures. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I'm Mark Nystrom. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here to tell you that our organization supports House Bill 3100.
Thank you. Ms. Burris, please.
My name is Rebecca Kappa-Burris, and I'm a patient at Oregon State Hospital. And I expect that I'm probably a wild card in this situation. I was discouraged from testifying, but I believe that it wouldn't serve our ends if we didn't boldly and purposely share our views. I'm very involved in the patient government at the state hospital. I'm the editor of the Journeys newsletter at the hospital, and I'm very fierce advocate of patients. I would like to read this on behalf of us as patients. We're patients at the Oregon State Hospital who are urging changes so that no Oregon law perpetuates misconceptions that those with a mental illness are any less capable of leading productive lives within our communities. We object to punishments being applied far more extensively because we live with disabilities. We're opposed to any current law that hinders productive treatment and a timely return to our lives. We contest the misappropriation of taxpayer resources to endlessly institutionalize Oregonians in violation of the Federal Olmstead Act. Therefore, we respectfully ask this committee for the following amendments to become part of House Bill 3100.
One person.
Here. And for the record, for the patients who I'm allied with, we are definitely not opposed. We support House Bill 3100, and we ask these amendments to be included. One, sentencing parity. The provisions in Senate Bill 420 remove stigma from those under the PSRB by making sentences equal to what one received in a regular correctional system while still allowing for civil commit upon completion. If necessary, we ask that the language be inserted that ensures this will apply to those currently under the PSRB. From a fiscal standpoint, we believe that it would be, for a sense of equity, the disparity, as I have here, disparity arises from failure to evolve in suit with the Olmstead Act of 1999 that was brought forward by the Supreme Court. Because we are under currently a system where it is purely decided by law, and a conservative part of the law at that, and psychologists aren't able to determine whether a person is mentally ill with disease or defect. Clinically, we believe it is a clinical position that must be decided. And 48 states out of 50 in the United States do not have a PSRB. And this is definitely in accord with the Americans with Disabilities Act under Olmstead versus LC, where it's required that once a doctor says you do not suffer from a mental disease or defect, you are to be released out in the community in the most integrated setting. And it is no, and there's no doubt that the voices of the patients have been oppressed in speaking about this for a long time, from one way or another. But we are indeed housed in this system. This system well beyond disproportionate, and disproportionately beyond what was really expected by the courts. We were expected to get well and released, not to have any kind of conservative bent on or sway by a very close-minded situation, persons who are representing harsh political views that have not necessarily intent, perhaps, but in act, in enforcement, punishment of mentally ill patients. Mentally ill patients are not criminals, yet we have unequal senses. We have sentences that are up to two or three times more than those prescribed by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission under their sentencing guidelines, which was brought forth and evolved in 1999. In 1999, the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission reformed the system, and they start going through sentencing guidelines instead of giving the statutory mandatory maximums. For instance, a Class A, 20 years under PSRB. In reality, for a person with only about two, in, on top of that, with two previous felonies, is 10 years. Class B, DLC, 10 years. Or 7 years, 6 months, mandatory measure 11. I'm sorry, excuse me, I have my facts wrong on that. A Class B for us is 10 years, but since the guidelines by this is a lot less. And Class C is 5 years maximum. And if you have two previous crimes under the sentencing guidelines, you have 3 to 6 months. Now, let's see. Okay. Are we pressed for time?
We are.
Okay. I don't want to disrespect that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and your testimony has been very important, and we really appreciate you coming over and giving that to us. It helps to have firsthand account like that.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing on...
Paul Snyder.
Oh, yeah, we do. I'm sorry, Paul Snyder. I'm sorry, I didn't... Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3100. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2707. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking for my file.
Chairman, 2707 comes to you from the House Judiciary Committee. Requires that a youth who is 15 or 16 in charge of a Measure 11 offense or waived to adult court be detained in a juvenile detention facility unless the director of the county juvenile department and sheriff agree to detain the juvenile in jail or other place where adults are detained.
Okay, thank you. This is the one for Christina McMahon, Tim Lowen, Lewin, or maybe Lowen, and Karen Nibbler. Please. And we are still pressed for time. We were trying to do some work sessions today. So please go ahead and take your, whoever wants to go first, and just identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and Chair Krieger and other members of the committee. My name is Christina McMahon. I'm currently the director of the Douglas County Juvenile Department. Prior to accepting that position about 6 years ago, I served as a deputy district attorney in the juvenile division of the Deschutes County Juvenile, in the Deschutes County DA's office, as well as prior to that, I was assigned to the juvenile division of the Marion County DA's office. So I bring a kind of a unique perspective to this issue. Philosophically, well, I'm here to represent myself, my county, and also members of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, who obviously can't be present today, all 36. Philosophically, I, like my colleagues in the Oregon Juvenile Directors Association, support the underlying philosophy that is driving this legislation. However, due to the practical realities that county juvenile departments face, we feel compelled to maintain a neutral position on the bill. I do want to highlight for you the specific reasons why we feel the philosophy underlying the bill is very important. First, let me use Douglas County as an example. If House Bill 2707 were to be enacted, it would serve to have no practical effect, no change in the way we do business in Douglas County. We lodge almost all Measure 11 youth in our facility, and that also is the case for 11 other counties besides Douglas who have adopted policies and practices where they have decided to maintain youth who have been charged with Measure 11 in their detention facilities. The reason we feel philosophically that this is so important is juvenile departments that operate juvenile detention centers have staff that are specifically trained in adolescent development and how to deal with youth that have the varying issues and conditions that brought them before the juvenile justice system and or the adult criminal justice system because they've been charged under Measure 11. In our facilities, they receive mandatory education because there are statutes that guide that. They receive programming, cognitive behavioral groups, mental health, and substance abuse counseling in many facilities. These are services that they would likely not receive if they were in an adult jail, which is why we've made this choice in Douglas County. And also, from a practical standpoint and a risk management standpoint, many times when youth are put into adult jails, they are held in isolation cells for their own protection. So that's an important thing to key into. The other issue is that we realize that it is really in the interest of the public to provide as many services to youth who are involved in the criminal justice system, whichever door they come through, whether it's through the juvenile or through the Measure 11 process, because eventually, except in the most serious of offenses, they will be returning to our community. So we want them to get as many services and opportunities to develop skills so that they can turn their lives around and in the future make different choices than the ones that led them to be involved in the system. The reason that I started by saying that we, as I personally and many of most of my colleagues in the Juvenile Directors Association, feel that we must maintain a neutral position is that while we're conflicted. We know there's a lot of research, such as research about adolescent brain development, that is clear. It's a whole decade's worth of research that indicates that adolescents are very different from adults in how they process their thoughts and their actions and their impulses, because their brains are still developing and aren't going to be finished developing usually until their mid-20s. So we're very conflicted. Philosophically, we know that this bill is in keeping with what the research and evidence shows are best practices for working with youth. However, we have to deal with the practical realities and the funding concerns that our county juvenile departments face. We are traditionally very underfunded to deal with the many issues that confront us. And in Oregon, there are only actually 14 detention facilities. While we have 36 counties, there are only 14 different detention facilities. So as you can see, the majority of counties do not have the luxury, like Douglas County currently has, of operating their own detention facilities and having immediate access to those detention beds. We feel that this bill could result in an unintentional unfunded mandate for many of those counties that don't have their own detention centers. I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Lowen because he's got more specifics about that aspect of it.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Tim Lowen. I'm the Juvenile Department Director for Yamhill County. I was a former president of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. I would like to say that we, as Christina had mentioned, we are split on this factor, and partly it comes down to the split oftentimes comes down to those who have and those who have not. The split can be both philosophical in terms of some folks are very supportive of the idea of not having kids in in adult facilities, but there are those that don't agree with that. They're looking at Measure 11 and believing that behind that there should be those 16, 17-year-olds should be treated as adults. There's also the fiscal impact. Many folks, in terms of the haves and have-nots, have detention facilities and have adequate resources to provide for those services. Presently, there's less than half that are providing those services in juvenile detention facilities. The greater majority of counties, not probably kids, but of counties in the state, use adult facilities. And they do so because of the cost effectiveness of doing so and not necessarily looking at the potential, well, not that they don't look at the safety issues and those kind of things, but unfortunately in our economy, money drives a lot of decisions and a lot of policy. For instance, in Yamhill County, it costs $175 a day for a youth in our detention facility. It costs $75 a day for that same youth in an adult facility. In Yamhill County, we made a decision some time ago that we would follow what's essentially in this bill, is that all our Measure 11 youth are housed in the juvenile facility, but that's because we have the resource. Many of the counties do not, and actually many of the counties that you represent do not. I want to just read a couple of these things. For instance, in Curry County contracts for detention beds, and currently we contract for 364 bed days a year. For the most part, we manage the beds and maintain our annual budget. Housing a Measure 11 youth offender differs vastly from housing the average youth offender, not only with regard to the time spent in detention, but also the numerous transports that are required for youth to attend court, psychological evaluations, and medical. Harney County has no detention beds available. We must purchase bed space from other counties on a day-to-day basis for all youth in detention. Measure 11 youth tend to be in detention for long periods of time while awaiting prosecution. Our access to our county jail is free to the juvenile department. Otherwise, we are paying $170 per day for detention. There's a number of other sort of comments like that. So there is a potential, and I say potential because we haven't arrived there yet. We haven't made a change. But the other issue here is we make, by adopting this in its present form, we make a default that changes the system to say, unless otherwise agreed upon by two entities within the county, it will default to the juvenile department. And the juvenile detention facility that they may contract with. Oftentimes those contracts are with other counties. Oftentimes they're with counties in another state because of some of our border counties. But it does present a fiscal impact, and it does potentially, I should say, present that fiscal impact for those counties who have no resources or have very limited resources. And the third point is in a climate where we're reducing our services already, under the governor's balanced budget, OIA will reduce almost 50% of the youth correctional facility beds, represents almost 75% of those that are available to counties under discretionary bed allocation. They're eliminating $9.1 million in basic allocations to county juvenile departments. There's a lot of reductions going on, and along with the many counties suffering from reductions in timber revenues. Our juvenile departments are, as many other programs in counties, are suffering, and there's a concern that this could change things. I appreciate your time, and would accept any questions.
Okay, thank you.
We could take a break and go to work session.
Karen Nibbler, I'm here for representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and we feel pretty strongly about this because they've spent some time studying juvenile justice and the adult correction system, and we feel really strongly that juveniles should not be placed in adult jails. That they get exposed to dangers in adult jails. They get exposed to criminal people who can teach them some other things in adult jails. And we prefer to have them housed in detention facilities where a school is available, and where also there's some professional services such as nurses. If they're on medications or something, then they can have those monitored better. But we think it's a good thing to have a default position that they go to detentions. And I should explain that I'm a retired juvenile counselor so for 14 years, so I have some familiarity with all this. anyway, sometimes you get a call in the middle of the night and they've picked somebody up in a different county, and it's, you know, where do you want them placed? And of course, you know, we'd want them, and the police officer that picks them up wants to place them in the closest detention facility. So sometimes you're negotiating, you know, where they're going to go. But facility, and then you can move them the next day. And that's usually what happens anyway. If they pick somebody up, they put them in the closest facility, and then they negotiate whether they're going to transfer them to a detention facility or to a jail in the county where they reside. So, anyway, this we feel strongly that the kids should remain in detention facilities as much as possible. And I do agree with Mr. Lowen that the OIA budget will impact this. And the basic services pays for the detention facilities. So that part of the budget needs to be funded in order to do this, in order to keep the detention facilities open and to make the beds available.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to suspend this hearing for a few minutes, close the public hearing on 707. Please excuse. And we're going to go to a couple quick work sessions. We have other people that have to leave the room in a few minutes. Open a work session on Hospital 2685.
Members of the committee, Hospital 2685 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar Family Law Section, and it basically allows for termination of the attorney-client relationship after entry of judgment or other final determination if notice of termination is filed. It requires the attorney to sign the notice and state all services declined to be provided. It does not have a negative fiscal impact, Mr. Chairman, as a committee, and there are no amendments.
Is there any discussion?
Call the roll, please.
I'm sorry. Chair, I move Hospital 2685 forward to pass recommendation.
Representative Schaffner moves Hospital 2685 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Excused.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wand?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Excused.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Close the work session on House Bill 2685. Open a work session on House Bill 20.
Carrier?
Consent calendar?
Consent calendar. Is there any objection to that going on the consent calendar? Open a work session, House Bill 2686. Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2686 comes to you for family law section. The bar repeals a 90-day waiting period for trial or hearing on merits of dissolution of marriage proceeding. Require party seeking post-judgment temporary order for custody parenting time to concurrently file a motion to permanently modify judgment that provides custody parenting time. Our visitation expands rights and responsibilities of unmarried parents and proceedings for custody support and parenting time. Mr. Chairman, this committee does not have a negative fiscal impact and there are no amendments.
Any discussion? Have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, move Hospital 2686 to the floor to pass recommendation.
Representative Schaffer moves Hospital 2686 to the floor to do pass. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson? Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wan?
Yes.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Excused.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye.
Representative Olson's excused. We didn't say that. Is there any objection to having this go to the consent calendar? Hearing none to the consent calendar. Close the work session on House Bill 2686. Open a work session, House Bill 2689.
Chairman of the committee, House Bill 2689 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. Adds language to the summons for appearance of juvenile court proceedings that if you are a party to the proceedings, you have a right to appeal a judgment to the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2689 for due pass recommendation.
Representative Schaffer moves House Bill 2689 to the floor for the due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Excuse.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative
Wan? Aye.
Representative
Wisnett? Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Excuse.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. If no objection, that will go on the consent calendar as well. Close the hearing on House Bill 2689 and reopen the hearing on House Bill 2707. Next we'll call Mark McEnany, Brad Berry, and Jasmine Bissonette.
Okay. You gotta be careful to do too many of them. This is the last one's gonna work.
Just go ahead and just state your name and go ahead.
Jasmine Bissonette.
Please go ahead.
My name is Jasmine Bissonette, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2707. I am currently a full-time Portland Community College student. I also serve as a youth member on the Oregon Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, the state advisory group that distributes, that makes recommendations on the distribution of federal funds to the state. Not that long ago, I was on a very different path. I am here to support House Bill 2707 because I have experienced both the juvenile and the adult system. At the age of 15, I was convicted of a Measure 11 crime and automatically tried in the adult system. Fortunately, the prosecutor in my case let me plead to a probationary sentence, and I served my sentence locally in the Multnomah County Juvenile Detention Center. While I was held in the juvenile facility, I got the education and drug treatment that I needed to help me be a more productive member of society. Staff at the juvenile facility ensured that I was held accountable for my crime and taught me that if I did not change my thoughts, that I could not change my behavior. I knew that if I was going to change, it would be while I had the chance to be in the juvenile facility. At one point after being released, I relapsed and was sent to jail. When I was in the adult jail, I saw no hope for me or my future. I was kept in an isolation cell the whole time and received no counseling to help me figure out how I could get back on track. In fact, it made me feel totally hopeless.
That's okay.
Luckily, I was sent back to the juvenile detention and received additional guidance to help me be successful. The staff at the DDH helped me to see that there was hope, and that they also helped me to be more accountable and helped me think about how making bad choices was a part of learning. I've learned from my mistakes.
And thank you, and we can see the fact that you're here today, that you're making good progress, and we wish you well and hope you're able to continue on the direction you're headed now. Thank you very much
for your
testimony. Appreciate how hard it is for you to come testify.
Thanks.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Brad Berry. I'm the Amhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. The ODAA is, I put us down as neutral on this, and it's more because we just have a couple of comments and questions about it. I think the idea is a good idea. It's a best practice, I would think. In our county, as Mr. Lowen mentioned, often our youth on Measure 11 offenses are housed in the juvenile detention facility. It is rare that they go to our jail facility. It's both by agreement between the sheriff and the juvenile department, as well as policies which I've implemented, which compel that to happen, actually. And I don't think anybody in the ODAA would disagree that that's the better place for it to be. We had some general concerns. One is this creates the presumption that they go to a detention facility, and as you've already heard, detention facilities are not the norm. We don't have them throughout the state, nor do we have sufficient beds. I note that in my county, we do have sufficient beds, both on the jail, as I say, on the jail end of the hall, and the juvenile detention end of the hall, but I would suggest we are rare in the state, and I'm not quite sure how that works out. Again, it's a question. It's a concern. I don't know how to go about that. If, in fact, there is an agreement between the sheriff and the juvenile department as to where a particular youth should be housed, that's great, but we, as an organization, as we discuss this bill, and I mentioned to Shannon earlier, the question is, what if they don't agree? And that, though I just pose this as a potential issue, and I don't know whether it is or is not, but if they don't agree, there is no provision for how that decision would be determined. And then the secondary question is, because in fact the sheriff is a constitutional officer and has many other statutory duties which are direct towards a person involved in the adult criminal justice system, would they not actually always trump that decision on where this youth but charged as an adult should be? Again, we don't have a dog in this fight. We didn't take the time to research it, but it was a question that several of us had as we thought about it, so just to ensure that the intent as it's put forward would be carried out. Whatever the end result is that you folks decide should move forward, we just want to be sure that question was posed. In sum, and to be quick, this is a good idea. Youth should be with youth as much as we can. They should be moved when they're out of control, for example, cannot be. They then pose a threat to the other youth in the detention facility. That's how we have it in our county. It's worked well for us, and I think it's a great idea.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chairs Barker and Krieger, excuse me, the members of the committee. My name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. We have just recently changed our name from the Juvenile Rights Project. Since 1975, we've represented roughly 50,000 children and youth in the juvenile court system, including children in foster care and youth in the juvenile justice system. I'm not going to repeat some of the points made about why this bill is such a good idea. I do want to draw your attention to our history with this issue. And we filed a federal civil rights action on behalf of several youth who had been housed in adult jails in the late 70s and early 80s. And the court opinion resulting from that case was DB versus Tewksbury in 1982. And the court, this was specifically about juveniles charged as juveniles who are being held in adult jails. So the issue is slightly different than the issue before you today, but there are many parallels. The court found that it was fundamentally unfair to house juveniles in adult jails, in particular in the cases where imprisonment in an adult facility was not a possible sentence that the youth would receive if they were convicted. And it's important to keep in mind that we are talking about pre-conviction, pre-adjudication detention in this bill. We're talking about youth who have not been convicted yet or may not be convicted of a crime. We're talking about youth who may not receive a Measure 11 sentence. They may be found guilty or plea to a charge that is less than a Measure 11 sentence. We also know that while it's not mandated, the practice in Oregon, once these youth are convicted, is to have them serve their sentences, and most of them can serve their entire sentences in juvenile facilities run by the Oregon Youth Authority if they're placed in any kind of incarceration. So the same logic applies that in this bill that the court applied in 1982, that it doesn't really make sense, and it smacks of unfairness to house youth who have not been found guilty of anything in an adult jail when likely upon conviction they will be placed in a juvenile facility. And I would just like to comment on the question about an unfunded mandate. As I read the bill, it certainly leaves flexibility for counties to make decisions to deviate from the presumption created in this bill. And that's simply what it creates, is a presumption that absent some different decision between the juvenile director and the sheriff, that youth who are under 18, even though they're charged as adults, will be held in juvenile facilities. And I think in practice, typically, the sheriff's budgets and the juvenile department's budgets are overseen by county commissions. And in the cases where they might disagree, there is a county commission who will be very interested in resolving those agreements based upon the resources that they have to work with locally. So again, Youth Rights and Justice urges your support of House Bill 2707. Thank you.
Just, I worked in Columbia County in the 70s. Sorry, remember those places. Thank you. Okay, thank you, panel. And I have one person left. Shannon Wright, did Shannon wish to testify?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee that are left. I will be quick. I know it's getting to the end of your day. My name is Shannon White. I am the Associate Director at Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're an organization that's been around for about 11 years and advocate for smart public safety policy, which for us means advocating for both victims and survivors of crime and for people and youth who've been convicted of crime. I also have 17 years of experience working in criminal and juvenile justice fields, and including co-founding a juvenile justice law and advocacy office in Louisiana. So I know how a state can do things wrong, and I'm here in part to say that Oregon does a lot right. We are supporting House Bill 2707, which would, as you have heard, change just the default facility for youth charged with adult crimes to juvenile detention. This is consistent, as Mark pointed out, with existing law that keeps youth in an Oregon Youth Authority facility after they've been convicted up until their 25th birthday. When Oregon created that policy back in 1995, it was way ahead of the research that people are speaking about now. There is a huge body of research out there, some of it put out notably by the Centers for Disease Control, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, that shows that youth who are held accountable in the juvenile justice system are more likely to succeed and be successful, and in fact that kids who are subjected to the adult criminal justice system are often more likely to commit future crimes. And I think, as has also been pointed out, what House Bill 2707 does is really just create consistency between two parts of our statute that I believe aren't really, one hand wasn't talking to the other. You know, that when kids are arrested, they would end up in an adult jail, but when they're convicted, they would end up in a youth facility. I do want to mention, with regard to the funding issue that's been raised, because I know I talked to all of you and some of you who aren't here, that it was our assumption that there was no unfunded mandate here, that this was an issue that would be resolved between the counties. This was only recently brought to my attention this week by the Juvenile Directors Association. I just want to be clear. I had been in conversation with them, and this was just a new issue that came up from some counties, I guess, who hadn't weighed in yet. But for the most part, Ledge Council and many of the directors had indicated that it was, they did not think it was a problem. These are issues that get worked out right now in counties over where they're going to hold kids. So I think, just quickly, I think as a state, everyone up here, I mean, it's actually kind of wonderful to hear from the DAs. The sheriffs asked me to report that they are neutral on the bill. They actually think it would be nice for kids to be in juvenile jails as well. That there's a whole range of stakeholders up here who agree that it's a best practice. I think the concerns that have been raised around funding may be a different conversation right now. Those issues seem to be worked out in individual counties. And so we were not aware until this week that that could be a problem. I do also want to mention that in light of some research our office has recently done on youth who've been prosecuted with Measure 11 over the last 15 years, that a total of 45% of children who are indicted for Measure 11 crimes are not ultimately sent to prison, so or any facility. Like, they either their case is dismissed, or they're plead down to a lesser, or they get a probationary charge. So we're really talking about a huge number of youth who could end up in an adult jail pretrial, who will never face sort of the adult consequences at the end of the system. So we're asking for your support for House Bill 2707.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2707. Any further business? Meeting adjourned.